The Cave of the Ancients by Tuesday Love Sang Grandpa, read to you by Blue Friend. October 2016. Chapter 6. The mid-morning service had ended. We boys rushed along to our classroom, shoving and pushing in an effort not to be the last one. Not because of our interest in education, but because the master at this class had the horrid habit of taking a swipe with his cane at the last one in. I, joy of joys, managed to be the first one in, and basked in the glow of approval of the master's smile. Impatiently he motioned the others to hurry, standing by the door and cuffing those who even appeared to be slow. At last we were all seated, sitting cross-legged upon the seat mats spread on the floor. As is our custom, we had our backs toward the master, who constantly patrolled behind us, so that we never knew where he was, and thus we had to work hard. Today we will discuss how all religions are similar, he intoned. We have observed how the story of the flood is common to all beliefs throughout the world. Now we will give our attention to the theme of the Virgin Mother. Even the meanest intelligence, he said, looking hard at me, knows that our Virgin Mother, the Blessed Dolma, the Virgin Mother of Mercy, corresponds to the Virgin Mother of certain sects of the Christian faith. Hurrying footsteps stopped at the entrance of the classroom. A monk messenger entered and bowed low to the master. "Salutations to you, learned one," he murmured. The Lord Lama, Mingyar Dondup, presents his compliments and requests that the boy, Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, be released from class immediately. The matter is urgent. The master scowled. "Boy," he thundered, "you are a nuisance and a disturber of the class. Get out." Hastily I jumped to my feet, bowed to the master, and rushed after the hurrying messenger. "What is it?" I gasped. "Don't know," he said. "Wondered myself. Holy Lama Dondup has surgical things ready, horses ready, too." We hurried on. "Ah, Lobsang, so you can hurry," laughed my guide as we came upon him. "We are going down to the village of Sho, where our surgical services are required." He mounted his horse and motioned for me to mount mine. This was always a difficult operation. Horses and I never seemed to be of one mind when it came to mounting. I walked towards the horse, and that creature walked sideways away from me. I slipped round to the other side and took a running jump before the horse knew what was happening. Then I tried to emulate mountain lichen with the tenacity of my grip. Snorting with exasperated resignation, the horse turned without help from me and followed the horse of my guide down the path. This horse of mine had the horrible habit of stopping at the steepest parts and looking over the edge, lowering his head and doing some kind of shimmy. I firmly believe he had a misplaced sense of humor and was fully aware of the effect he had upon me. We clattered down the path and soon passed the Pargo Kaling, or Western Gate, and thus came upon the village of Sho. My guide led the way through the streets until he came to a big building which I recognized as the prison. Guards hurried out and took our horses. I picked up the two cases of my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, and carried them into the gloomy place. This was unpleasant, a horrible spot indeed. I could smell the fear, see the evil thought forms of wrongdoers. It was indeed a place, the atmosphere of which made the hair stand out upon the back of my neck. I followed my guide into a fairly large room. The sunlight was streaming through the windows. A number of guards were standing about, and waiting to greet the Lama Mingyur Dondup was the magistrate of Sho. While they talked, I looked about me. This, I decided, was where criminals were tried and sentenced. Around the walls were records and books. On the floor to one side was a groaning bundle. I looked toward it and at the same time heard the magistrate talking to my guide. "Chinese spy, we think, Honorable Lama. He was trying to climb the holy mountain, apparently trying to creep into the patala. He slipped and fell." "How far?" "Perhaps 100 feet. He's in a bad way." My guide moved forward, and I went to his side. A man pulled back the covers, and before us we saw a Chinese man of about middle age. He was fairly small and looked as though he had been remarkably agile, something like an acrobat, I thought. Now he was groaning with pain, his face wet with perspiration, and his complexion a muddy greenish tinge. The man was in a bad state, shivering and grinding his teeth in his agony. The Lama, Mingyur Dondup, looked at him with compassion. "Spy, would-be assassin, or whatever he is, we must do something for him," he said. My guide knelt beside the man and put his hands on the suffering wretch's temples and gazed into his eyes. Within seconds, the sick man relaxed, eyes half open, a vague smile on his lips. My guide pulled the coverings further aside, then bent over his legs. I felt sick at what I saw. The man's leg bones protruding through his trousers. The legs appeared to be completely shattered. With the sharp knife, my guide cut off the man's clothing. There was a gasp from the onlookers as they saw the leg with bones completely shattered from feet to thighs. The Lama gently felt them. The injured man did not stir or flinch. He was deeply hypnotized. The leg bones grated and sounded like half-filled sandbags. "The bones are too shattered to be set," said my guide. "His legs seem to be pulverized. We shall have to amputate them." "Honorable Lama," said said the magistrate. Can you make him tell us what he was doing? We fear he's an assassin. We will remove his legs first, replied the lama. Then we can ask him. He bent over the man again and gazed once more into his eyes. The Chinese relaxed even more and appeared to go into a deep sleep. I had the bags unrolled and the sterilized herbal fluid ready in the bowl. My guide dipped in his hands so that they could soak. I had his instruments already in another bowl. At his direction, I washed the man's body and legs. Touching those legs sent a peculiar feeling through me. It felt as though everything was shattered. Now they were a blue, mottled color, with the veins standing out like black cords. Under the directions of my guide, who was still soaking his hands, I placed sterilized bands as high as I could on the Chinese man's legs, high where they joined the body. Sliding a stick into a loop, I turned until the pressure stopped the circulation. Very quickly, the Lama Mingyar Dondup seized a knife and cut the flesh in a V. At the point of the V, he sawed through the leg bone, what was left of it, and then tucked in the two flaps of the V so that the end of the bone was protected by a double layer of flesh. I passed him thread made from the sterilized parts of yak, and speedily he stitched the flaps tightly together. Slowly, carefully, I eased the pressure of the band about the man's legs, ready to tighten again should the stump bleed. The stitches held. No blood flowed. Behind us, a guard retched violently, turned chalk white, and fell to the floor in a faint. Carefully, my guide bandaged the stump and again washed his hands in the solution. I gave my attention to the other leg, the left, and slid the stick through the loop in the band. The lama nodded, and I turned the stick once more to shut off the blood from that leg. Soon, that limb was lying beside the other. My guide turned to a staring guard and told him to take the legs and wrap them up in cloth. We must return these legs to the Chinese mission, said the lama, or they will say that their man has been tortured. I shall ask the inmost one that this man be returned to his people. His mission doesn't matter. It failed, as all such attempts will. But honorable lama, said the magistrate, the man should be forced to tell us what he was doing and why. My guide said nothing, but turned again to the hypnotized man and looked deeply into his now opened eyes. What were you doing? He asked. The man groaned and rolled his eyes. My guide asked him again. What were you going to do? Were you going to assassinate a high person within the patella? Froth formed around the man's mouth, and then, reluctantly, he nodded his head in confirmation. Speak, commanded the lama. A nod is not enough. So, slowly, painfully, the story came out. An assassin, paid to do murder, paid to stir up trouble in a peaceful country. An assassin who had failed, as all would fail, through not knowing of our safety devices. As I was musing upon this, the Lama, Mingyar Dondup, rose to his feet. "I will go to see the inmost one, Lobsang. You stay here and guard this man," he said. The man groaned. "You kill me?" he asked weakly. "No," I replied. "We kill no one." I moistened his lips and mopped his brow. Soon he was still again. I think he slept after the exhausting ordeal. The magistrate looked on sourly, thinking that priests were crazy to want to save a would-be assassin. The day dragged on. Guards went out and others came in. I felt my interior crumble with hunger. At last I heard familiar footsteps, and the Lama, Mingyar Dondup, strode into the room. First he came and looked at the patient, making sure that the man was as comfortable as the circumstances permitted, and that the stumps were not bleeding. Rising to his feet, he looked at the senior lay official and said, "By virtue of the authority vested in me by the Inmost One, I command you to obtain 2 litters immediately and take this man and his legs to the Chinese mission." He turned to me. "You will accompany these men and report to me if they are unnecessarily rough in their handling of the man's litter." I felt distinctly gloomy. Here was this assassin with his legs cut off, and my stomach rumbling away as empty of food as a temple drum. While the men were absent in search of litters, I rushed outside to where I had seen the officials drinking tea. In a haughty voice, I demanded, and I got, a generous helping. Hastily cramming Zampa down my throat, I rushed back. Silently, sullenly, the men filed into the room after me, carrying 2 rough litters, cloth stretched between the poles. Grumpily, they picked up the 2 legs and put them on 1 litter. Gently, under the keen eyes of the Lama, Mingyar Dondup, they placed the Chinese man upon the other litter. A cover was placed over his body and tied under the litter so that he could not be jolted off. My guide turned to the senior lay official and said, "You will accompany these men and you will present my compliments to the Chinese ambassador, and you will tell him we are returning one of his men. You, Lobsang," he turned to me, "will accompany them, and on your return, you'll report to me." He turned away, and the men trudged out of the room. The air was chilly outside, and I shivered in my light robe. Down the Mani Laking we trudged, the men carrying the legs first, and then the 2 men carrying the litter with the Chinese. I walked to one side, and the senior lay official walked on the other. We turned off to the right, past the 2 parks, and headed on towards the Chinese mission. with the happy river glinting ahead of us, showing flecks of bright light through gaps in the trees, we came to the farthermost wall of the mission. Grunting, the men put their loads down for a time, while they rested their aching muscles and looked curiously at the mission wall. The Chinese were very offensive to anyone who tried to intrude on their ground. There had been cases of small boys being shot by accident when they trespassed, as small boys will. Now we were going inside. Spitting on their hands, the men stooped and picked up the litters again. Marching on, we turned left into the Lingkor Road and entered the mission grounds. Surly men came to the door, and the senior official said, "I have the honor to return to you one of your men who attempted to stray into holy ground. He fell, and his legs had to be amputated. Here are the legs for your inspection." Scowling guards seized the handles and rushed into the building with the man and his legs. Others, at gunpoint, waved us away. We retreated down the path. I slipped unseen behind a tree. The others marched on. Screams and shouts rent the air. Looking about, I saw that there were no guards. They had all entered the mission. On a foolish impulse, I left the doubtful security of the tree and ran silently to the window. The injured man was lying on the floor. One guard was sitting on his chest, while two more sat on his arms. A fourth man was applying burning cigarettes to his amputated stumps. Suddenly, the fourth man jumped to his feet, drew his revolver, and shot the injured man between the eyes. A twig cracked behind me. Like a flash, I dropped to my knees and turned about. Another Chinese guard had appeared and was aiming a rifle at where my head had been. I dived between his legs, tripping him and causing him to drop his rifle. Hastily I ran from tree to tree. Shots came ripping through the low branches, and there was a thud of running feet behind me. Here the advantage was wholly mine. I was fleet of foot, and the Chinese stopped often to take shots at me. I rushed to the back of the garden. The gate was now guarded. Climbed up a convenient tree and inched along a branch so that I could drop on to the top of the wall. Seconds later, I was back on the road ahead of my countrymen who had carried in the injured man. As soon as they heard my story, they hurried up their footsteps. No longer were they tarrying in the hope of seeing some excitement. Now they wanted to avoid it. A Chinese guard dropped off the top of the wall onto the road and glared at me most suspiciously. I blandly gazed back at him. With a scowl and a muttered oath which reflected adversely on my parentage, he turned away. We put on speed. Back at the village of Shou, the men left me. Looking somewhat apprehensively over my shoulder, I hurried on and soon was speeding up the path to Shakpori. An old monk resting by the wayside called after me, "What is wrong with you, Lob Sang? You look as if all the demons were after you." I rushed on, and breathless entered the room of my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup. For a moment I stood panting, trying to get my breath. "Oh," I gasped at last, "the Chinese murdered that man. They shot him." In a torrent of words, I told all that had happened. My guide was silent for a moment, and then he said, "You will see much violence in your life, Lob Sang, so do not be too distressed at this event. This is the usual method of diplomacy. Kill those who fail, and disclaim spies who are caught. It goes on all over the world, in all countries of the world." Sitting in front of my guide, recovering in the calm serenity of his presence, I thought of another matter which was troubling me. "Sir," I exclaimed, "how does hypnotism work?" He looked across at me with a smile on his lips. "When did you eat last?" he queried. With a rush, all my hunger came back. "Oh, about 12 hours ago," I replied somewhat ruefully. "Then let us eat now, here, and then when we are somewhat refreshed, we can discuss hypnotism." He waved me to silence and sat in the attitude of meditation. I caught his telepathic message to his servants, food and tea. I caught, too, a telepathic message to someone at the Patella, someone who had to go to the inmost one in a hurry to give a detailed report. But my interception of the telepathic message was interrupted by the entry of a servant bringing food and tea. I sat back, replete with food, feeling even more uncomfortably full. I had had a hard day. I had been hungry for many, many hours, but, the thought troubled me internally, had I eaten too much unwisely now? Suddenly, suspiciously, I looked up. My guide was gazing down upon me with obvious amusement on his face. "Yes, Lob Sang," he remarked, "you have eaten too much. I hope you'll be able to follow my talk on hypnotism." He studied my flushed face, and his own look softened. "Poor Lob Sang, you have had a hard day. Go to your rest now, and we'll continue our discussion on the morrow." He rose to his feet and left the room. I climbed wearily to mine and almost tottered along the corridor. Sleep, that was all I wanted. Food, no, I'd had too much of that. I reached my bed place and rolled myself in my robes. Sleep was troubled indeed. I had nightmares in which legless Chinese chased me through wooded groves, and other Chinese armed with guns kept jumping on my shoulders in an attempt to bring me down. Thump went my head on the ground. One of the Chinese guards was kicking me. Thump went my head again. Blearily, I opened my eyes to find an acolyte energetically banging my head and kicking me in a desperate attempt to wake me. "Lobsang," he exclaimed, as he saw that my eyes were open. "Lobsang, I thought you were dead. You have slept all through the night, missed the services, and only the intervention of your master, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, has saved you from the proctors. Wake up!" he shouted, as I almost lapsed into sleep again. Consciousness flooded into me. Through the windows I saw the early morning rays of sunlight peering over the high Himalayas and lighting up the tallest buildings in the valley, showing the golden roofs of the distant Serra glowing along the top of the Pargo Kaling. Yesterday I had gone to the village of Sho. Ah, that was not a dream. Today, I hoped to miss some lessons and learn direct from my beloved Mingyar Dondup. Learn about hypnotism, too. Soon I finished my breakfast and was on my way to the classroom, not to stay and recite from the 108 sacred books, but to explain why I was not. "Sir," I said, as I saw the teacher just going into the classroom, "Sir, I have to attend the Lama Mingyar Dondup this day. I beg to be excused from class." "Ah, yes, my boy," said the teacher in amazingly genial tones. "I've had a word with the Holy Lama, your guide. He was good enough to comment favorably upon your progress under my care. I confess I am most gratified, most gratified." Astonishingly, he extended his hand and patted me on the shoulder before entering the classroom. Bemused and wondering what sort of magic I had worked upon him, I wandered off towards the Lama's quarters. On I strolled without a care in the world, past a half-open doorway. "Oh," I exclaimed suddenly, coming to a sudden stop, "pickled walnuts!" The scent of them was strong. Backtracking silently, I peered through the doorway. An old monk was staring down at the stone floor, muttering things which were not his prayers, mourning the loss of a whole jar of pickled walnuts which had somehow been obtained from India. "May I help you, Reverend Lama?" I asked politely. The old man turned a ferocious face to me and made such a rejoinder that I raced off along the corridor while I was still able. "All those words just for a few walnuts," I said disgustedly to myself. "Come in," said my guide as I approached his door. "I thought you'd gone back to sleep." "Sir," I said, "I have come to you for instruction. I'm anxious to know the nature of hypnotism." "Lobsang," said my guide, "you have to learn much more than that. You have to learn the basis for hypnotism first. Otherwise, you do not know exactly what you do. Sit down." I sat, cross-legged, of course, upon the floor. My guide sat opposite me. For a time, he seemed lost in thought, and then said, "By now, you should have realized that everything is vibration, electricity. The body has many different chemicals in its composition. Certain of those chemicals are conveyed to the brain by the bloodstream. The brain, you know, has the best supply of blood and its contained chemicals. Those ingredients, potassium, manganese, carbon, and many others, form the brain tissue. Interaction between them makes a peculiar oscillation of molecules, which we term an electric current. When one thinks, one sets in motion a chain of circumstances which results in the formulation of this electric current, and hence brain waves. I pondered the whole matter. I could not see all this. If there were electric currents in my brain, why did I not feel the shock? That boy who was flying a kite, I recalled, had been doing so in a thunderstorm. I remember the vivid blue flash as lightning traveled along his wet kite line. I remembered with a shudder how he had fallen to the ground as a dried up, fried crisp of flesh. And once I had a shock, too, from the same source, a mere tingle compared to the other, but tingle enough to throw me a dozen feet. Honorable Lama, I expostulated, how can there be electricity in the brain? It would drive a man mad with the pain. My guide sat and laughed at me. Lapsang, he chuckled, the shock you once had has given you a wholly incorrect idea of electricity. The amount of electricity in the brain is of a very small order indeed. Delicate instruments can measure it and can actually chart the variations as one thinks or undertakes some physical action. The thought of one man measuring another man's voltage was almost too much for me, and I started to laugh. My guide merely smiled and said, "Let us, this afternoon, walk over to the patella. The inmost one there has a device which will enable us to talk more easily on this electrical subject. Go now and entertain yourself. Have a meal, put on your best robe, and meet me here when the sun is at noon." I rose to my feet, bowed, and went out. For 2 hours I wandered around, climbing to the roof and idly flicking small pebbles onto the unsuspecting heads of monks passing below. Tiring of that sport, I lowered myself headfirst through the trap hatch leading down to a dark corridor. Hanging upside down by my feet, I was just in time to hear approaching footsteps. I could not see because the trap hatch was at a corner. Sticking out my tongue and making a ferocious face, I waited. An old man came round the corner, not being able to see me, bumped into me. My wet tongue touched his cheek. He emitted a shriek, and dropping the tray he was carrying with a crash, he disappeared at a speed surprising in such an old man. I, too, had a surprise. As the old monk bumped into me, it dislodged my feet from their precarious hold. I fell on my back into the corridor. The trap hatch fell with a resounding crash, and a whole load of choking dust fell on top of me. Scrambling dizzily to my feet, I made off as fast as I could in the opposite direction. Still suffering from the shock, I changed my robe and had a meal. I was not shocked enough to forget that. Punctually, as the shadows vanished and the day was at noon, I presented myself before my guide. With some effort, he composed his features as he saw me. An elderly monk, Lob sang, swears that he was beset by a devil in the north corridor. A party of three lamas has gone there to exorcise the devil. No doubt I shall be doing my part if I take him, you, to the Potala as arranged. Come. He turned and walked out of the room. I followed behind, casting apprehensive glances about me. After all, one never knew for sure what would happen if the lamas were exorcising. I had vague visions of finding myself flying through the air to some unknown, probably uncomfortable, destination. Out we went into the open. Two ponies were being held by grooms. The lama, Mingyar donned up, mounted, and slowly rode off down the mountains. I was helped onto my pony, and one of the grooms playfully gave him a slap. The pony felt playful, too. Down went his head, up went his rear, and off his back in an arc went I. A groom again held the animal, while I picked myself up from the ground and brushed off some dust. And then I mounted again, watching warily in case the grooms tried anything else. That pony knew he had a duffer aboard. The moronic animal kept walking to the most dangerous places and stopping on the very edge. Then he'd lower his head and gaze earnestly at the rocky ground so far below. At last I dismounted and towed the pony behind me. It was quicker. At the bottom of Iron Mountain, I again mounted and followed my guide into the village of Sho. He had some business there which detained us for a few moments. Time enough for me to regain my breath and my shattered composure. Then, mounting again, we climbed up the broad, stepped way to the Potala. Gladly, I relinquished my pony to the waiting grooms. Even more gladly, I followed the lama, Mingyar Dondup, to his own apartment. My pleasure was increased by the knowledge that I should be staying here for a day or two. Soon it was time to attend the service in the temple below. Here at the Potala, services were, I thought, excessively formal, the discipline too strict. Having had more than enough of excitement for one day, as well as suffering from many small bruises, I remained on my best behavior, and the service was concluded without incident. It was now an accepted thing that when my guide was at the Potala, I should occupy a small room adjoining his. I went there and sat down to await events, knowing that the lama, Mingyar Dondup, was engaged in matters of state with a very senior official who had recently returned from India. It was fascinating to look out the window and see the city of Lhasa in the distance. The view was one of surpassing beauty. Willow-fringed lakes, golden gleams from the Jokang, and the milling throng of pilgrims who clamored at the foot of the holy mountain in the hope of seeing the Inmost One, who was in residence, or at least some high official. An interminable string of traders and their beasts were just wending their slow way past the Pargo Kaling. I dwelt for a moment upon their exotic loads, but was interrupted by a soft footstep behind me. "We will have tea," Lobsang, "and then we will continue with our talk," said my guide, who had just entered. I followed him to his room, where was laid out fare very different from that normally served to a poor monk. Tea, of course, but sweet things from India, too. It was all very much to my taste. Normally monks never talk when they eat. It is considered to be disrespectful to the food, but on this occasion my guide told me that the Russians were attempting to make trouble for Tibet, were attempting to infiltrate spies. Soon we finished our meal and then made our way to the rooms where the Dalai Lama stored many strange devices from far-off lands. For a time, we just looked about us. The Lama, Mingyar Dondup, pointed out odd objects and explaining their uses. At last, he stopped in a corner of one room and said, "Look at this, Lobsang." I moved to his side and was not at all impressed with what I saw. Before me, on a small table, stood a glass jar. Inside there hung two thin threads, each supporting, at their far end, a small sphere of something that appeared to be pith from a willow tree. "It is pith," commented my guide dryly, when I remarked upon the matter. "You, Lobsang," said the Lama, "think of electricity as something that gives you a shock. There is another kind, or manifestation, which we term static electricity. Now watch." From the table, the Lama Mingyar Dondup took a shiny rod, possibly about 12 to 14 inches long. Briskly, he rubbed the rod on his robe and then brought it close to the glass jar. To my intense surprise, the two pith spheres flew violently apart and stayed apart, even when the rod was withdrawn. "Keep watching," exhorted my guide. Well, that is what I was doing. After some minutes, the pith balls slowly sank down again under the normal pull of gravity. Soon they were hanging straight down as they had before the experiment. "You try it," commanded the Lama, extending the black rod to me. "By the blessed Dolman," I cried, "I'm not touching that thing." My guide laughed heartily at my more than distressed expression. "Try it, Lobsang," he said mildly, "for I have never played a trick on you yet." "Yes," I grumbled, "but there's always the first time." He pressed the rod upon me. Gingerly I took the awful object. Reluctantly, half-heartedly, expecting a shock at any moment, I rubbed the rod on my robe. There was no sensation, no shock or tingle. At last I held it towards the glass jar, and wonder of wonders, the pith balls flew apart again. "As you observe, Lobsang," remarked my guide, "electricity is flowing, yet even you feel no shock. Such is the electricity of the brain. Come with me." He led me to another table, upon which rested a most remarkable device. It appeared to be a wheel, upon whose surface there were innumerable metal plates. Two rods were fixed so that a spray of wires from each lightly touched two of the metal plates. From the rods, wires trailed to two metal spheres, which were about a foot apart. The thing made no sense at all to me. "Statue of a devil," I thought. My guide confirmed that impression by his next move. Grasping a handle, which projected from the back of the wheel, he gave it a very hearty twirl. With a growl of rage, the wheel sprang to life, flashing and winking. From the metal spheres, a great tongue of blue lightning leaped, hissing and crackling. There was a strange smell, as if the air itself were burning. I waited no longer. This most definitely was not the place for me. I dived beneath the biggest table and tried to wiggle my way to the far distant door. The hissing and crackling stopped, to be replaced by another sound. I checked my flight and listened in amazement. Was it the sound of laughter? Never. Nervously, I peered out from my sanctuary. There was the Lama Mingyur Dandup, almost doubled up with laughter. Tears of merriment were trickling from his eyes, while his face was red with amusement. He seemed to be gasping for breath, too. "Oh, Lobsang," he said at last, "that is the first time I have known anyone to be frightened of a Wimhurst machine. These devices are used in many foreign countries, that the properties of electricity may be demonstrated." I crept out, feeling rather silly, and had a closer look at the strange machine. The Lama said, "I will hold these two wires, Lobsang, and you turn the handle as fast as you can. You'll see lightning flash all over me, but it will not harm me. It will not cause me pain. Let us try. Who knows? Perhaps you'll have an opportunity to laugh at me." He took two wires, one in each hand, and nodded for me to start. Grimly, I seized the handle and turned as fast as I could. I shouted in amazement as great purple and violet bands of lightning streamed across my guide's hands and face. He was quite unperturbed. Meanwhile, the smell had started again. "Ozone, quite harmless," said my guide. At last, I was persuaded to hold the wires with the llama turning the handle. The hissing and crackling was fearsome in the extreme, but as for feeling, it was more like a cool breeze than anything else. The llama took various glass things from a box and one by one connected them to the machine by wires. As he turned the handle, I saw a bright flame burning inside a glass bottle, and in other bottles a cross and other metal shapes outlined by living fire. But nowhere could I get a feeling of electric shock. With this Wimhurst machine, my guide demonstrated how a person who was not clairvoyant could be enabled to see the human aura. But more of that later. Eventually, the fading light caused us to desist from our experiments and to return to the llama's room. First, there was the evening service again. Our life in Tibet seemed to be completely circumscribed by the needs for religious observance. With the service behind us, we returned once again to my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup's apartment. Here we sat in our usual cross-legged attitude upon the floor, with the little table, perhaps 14 inches high, between us. "Now, Lobsang," said my guide, "we have to get down to this matter of hypnotism, but first of all, we have to decide upon the operation of the human brain. I have shown you, I hope, that there can be the passage of an electric current without one experiencing pain or discomfort therefrom. Now I want you to consider that when a person thinks, he generates an electric current. We need not go into the matter of how an electric current stimulates muscle fiber and causes reaction. Our whole interest for the moment is the electric current, the brain waves which have been so clearly measured and charted by Western medical science. I confess that I found this to be of some interest to me, because in my small and humble way it had already occurred to me that thought had force, because I remembered that parchment perforated cylinder which I had used at times in the lamasery, and which I had caused to rotate by my thought power alone. "Your attention is wandering, Lobsang," said my guide. "I'm sorry, honorable master," I replied. "I was merely reflecting upon the undoubted nature of thought waves, and considering the amusement I derived from that cylinder to which you introduced me some months ago." My guide looked at me and said, "You are an entity, an individual, and you have your own thoughts. You may consider that you will do some course of action, such as lift that rosary. Even in considering an action, your brain causes electricity to flow from its chemical constituents, and the wave from the electricity prepares your muscle for the impending action. If a greater electrical force should occur in your brain, then your original intention of lifting that rosary would be thwarted. It is easy to see that if I can persuade you that you cannot lift that rosary, then your brain, being beyond your immediate control, will generate and send out an opposing wave. You will then be unable to lift the rosary or do the contemplated action. I looked at him and thought of the affair, and it really did not make much sense to me, for how could he influence how much electricity my brain was generating? I thought about it, and I looked at him and wondered if I should voice my doubt. There was no necessity to, however, for he divined it and hastened to set my mind at rest. I can assure you, Lobsang, that what I say is demonstrable fact. And in a Western country, we should be able to prove all this under a piece of apparatus which would chart the three basic brain waves. Here, however, we have no such facilities, and we can only debate the matter. The brain generates electricity. It generates waves, and if you decide to lift your arm, then your brain generates waves on the intention of your decision. If I can, in rather technical words, feed a negative charge into your brain, then your original intention would be frustrated. In other words, you would be hypnotized. This really did begin to make sense. I had seen that Wimshurst machine, and I had seen various demonstrations conducted with its assistance, and I had seen how it was possible to alter the polarity of a current and so cause it to flow in the opposite direction. "Honorable Lama," I exclaimed, "how is it possible for you to feed a current into my brain?" "You cannot take off the top of my head and put some electricity inside. How then may it be done?" "My dear Lobsang," said my guide, "it's not necessary to get into your head, because I do not have to generate any electricity and put it into you. I can make appropriate suggestions whereby you will be convinced of the accuracy of my statement or suggestions, and you will then, without any voluntary control on your part, generate that negative current yourself." He looked at me and said, "I am most unwilling to hypnotize anyone against their will, except in a case of medical or surgical necessity. But I think that with your cooperation, it might be a good idea to demonstrate a simple little matter of hypnotism." I exclaimed hastily, "Oh, yes, I should love to experience hypnotism." He rather smiled at my impetuosity and asked, "Now, Lobsang, what would you be unwilling to do normally?" "I ask you that because I want to hypnotize you into doing something that you would not willingly do, so that you personally can be assured that in doing this thing you are acting under involuntary influence." I thought for a moment, and really I hardly knew what to say. There were so many things I didn't want to do. I was saved further thought on this matter by my guide, who exclaimed, "I know. You were not at all anxious to read that rather involved passage in the 5th volume of the Kang Yur. You were, I believe, rather afraid that some of the terms used would betray you, and betray the fact that on that particular subject you had not studied so assiduously as desired by your tutor." I felt rather gloomy about that, and I confess I also felt my cheeks reddened with some embarrassment. It was perfectly true. There was a particularly difficult passage in the book which caused me extreme difficulty. However, in the interests of science, I was quite prepared to be persuaded to read it. Actually, I had almost a phobia against reading that particular passage. My guide smiled and said, "The book is over there, just to the side of the window. Bring it here, turn to that passage, and read it out loud. And if you will try not to read it, if you will try to mess up the whole thing, then that will be a much better test." I reluctantly went across and fetched the book, and unwillingly turned over the pages. Our Tibetan pages are much bigger, much heavier than Western books. I fumbled and fumbled and made the thing as long, drawn out as possible. In the end, though, I turned to the appropriate passage, and I confess that this particular passage, because of some earlier incident with the tutor, really did make me feel almost physically sick. I stood there with the book in front of me, and try as I might, I could not articulate those words. It may seem strange, but it's a fact, because I had been so ill-used by a non-understanding tutor, I had developed a real hatred for those sacred sentences. My guide looked at me, nothing more, just looked at me. And then something seemed to click inside my head, and I found to my very considerable surprise that I was reading, not just reading, but reading fluently, easily, without a trace of hesitation. As I reached the end of the paragraph, I had the most inexplicable sensation. I put down the book, and I went to the middle of the room, and I stood on my head. "I'm going crazy," I thought. "Whatever will my guide think of me for behaving in this utterly foolish manner?" Then it occurred to me that my guide was making me, or influencing me, to behave this way. Quickly I jumped to my feet and found that he was smiling most benevolently upon me. "It really is a most easy matter," Lobsang, "to influence a person. There is no difficulty at all when one has mastered the basic matter. I merely thought of certain things, and you picked up my thoughts telepathically, and that caused your brain to react in the manner I had anticipated. Thus, certain fluctuations in your normal brain pattern were caused, which produced this quite interesting result." "Honorable Lama," I said, "then does it mean that if we can put an electric current into a person's brain, we can make that person do anything we want? No, it does not mean that at all, said my guide. It means instead that if we can persuade a person to do a certain course of action, and the course of action which we desire to persuade is not contrary to that person's belief, then he will undoubtedly do it, merely because his brain waves have been altered, and no matter what his original intention, he will act as suggested by the hypnotist. In most cases, a person receives suggestions from a hypnotist. There is no real influence exerted by the hypnotist other than the influence of suggestion. The hypnotist, by certain little tricks, is able to induce a course of action in the victim contrary to that which was originally contemplated. He looked at me seriously for a moment and then added, "Of course, you and I have other powers than that. You will be able to hypnotize a person instantly, even against a person's wishes. That gift is being made unto you because of the peculiar nature of your life, because of the very great hardships, and because of the exceptional work which you're going to have to achieve." He sat back and gazed at me in order that he might determine if I had assimilated the information which he had given me. Satisfied that I had, he continued, "Later, not yet, you will be taught much more about hypnotism and how to hypnotize quickly. I want to tell you that you will also have your telepathic powers increase because when you journey from here far out into other countries, you will need to keep in touch with us at all times, and the quickest and the most accurate way is by telepathy." I felt quite gloomy over all of this. I seemed the whole time to be learning something fresh, and the more I learned, the less time I had for myself. It seemed to me that more and more work was being added to me, but none was being lifted off. "But, Honorable Lama," I said, "how does telepathy work? Nothing appears to happen between us. Yet you know almost everything I think, especially when I don't want you to." My guide looked at me and laughed and said, "It really is quite a simple matter, telepathy. One merely has to control the brain waves. Look at it in this way. You think. Your brain generates electric currents which fluctuate in accordance with the variations of your thought. Normally, your thoughts go to activate a muscle so that a limb may be raised or lowered, or you may be thinking of a certain subject at a distance. Whatever way it is, your mental energy is broadcast. That is, the energy force from your brain is emitted indiscriminately in all and every direction. If there was some method whereby you could focus your thought, then it would be of very much greater intensity in the direction in which it was focused." I looked at him, and I remembered a little experiment which he had shown me some time before. We had been in much the same position as now, that is, high up on the peak, as we Tibetans call the Potala. The Lama, my guide, had in the darkness of the night lighted a small candle, and the light glimmered faintly around. But then he had put a magnifying glass in front of the candle, and by adjusting the distance of the magnifying glass from the flame, he had been able to project upon the wall a much brighter image of the candle flame. To increase the lesson, he had put a shiny surface behind the candle, and that, in turn, had concentrated the light more, so that the image upon the wall was even greater. I mentioned this to him, and he said, "Yes, that is perfectly correct. By various tricks, it is possible to focus the thought and to send it in a certain predetermined direction. Actually, every person has what we might term an individual wavelength, that is, the amount of energy on the basic wave emitted from the brain of any one person follows a precise order of oscillation, and if we could determine the rate of oscillation of the basic brain wave of another person and tune in to that basic oscillation, we should have no difficulty whatever in conveying our message by so-called telepathy, irrespective of the distance." He gazed firmly at me and added, "You must get it quite clear in your mind, Lobsang, that distance means nothing whatever when it comes to telepathy. Telepathy can span oceans. It can even span worlds." I confess that I was most anxious to do more in the realm of telepathy. I could visualize myself talking to one of my fellows who were at other lamasseries, such as Sarah, or even in far-off districts. It seemed to me, though, that all of my efforts had to be devoted to things which would help me in the future. A future which, according to all prophecies, would be a gloomy affair indeed. My guide interrupted my thoughts again. "We will go into this matter of telepathy later. We will also go into the matter of clairvoyance, for you will have abnormal powers of clairvoyance, and it will ease things for you if you are aware of the mechanics of the process. It all revolves around brain waves and interrupting the Akashic record. But night is upon us. We must cease our discussion for the moment and prepare for sleep, that we may, during the night hours, be refreshed in time for the first service." He rose to his feet and I rose to mine. I bowed to him in the attitude of respect, and I wished that I could show more adequately the profound respect which I felt for this great man who had so befriended me. Briefly, a fleeting smile crossed his lips, and he stepped forward, and I felt his warm hand clasp upon my shoulder. A gentle pat, and he said, "Good night, Lobsang. We must not delay any longer, or we shall be logheads again, unable to awaken when it is time for us to attend our devotions." In my own room, I stood for some moments by the window, with the cold night air blowing in. I gazed out upon the lights of Lhasa, and reflected upon all that had been told to me, and upon all that I had yet to learn. It was obvious to me that the more I learned, the more there was to learn, and I wondered where it would all end. With a sigh, perhaps of despair, I rolled myself more tightly in my robe and lay down upon the cold floor to sleep. End of chapter 6.